Good morning. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. Can you guys hear me back there okay? All right, if you can't at some point, and you want to, make a gesture. All right, so this is a holiday week. It's good to see a lot of folks here. We're getting close to the solstice, so it's Christmas week and Hanukkah and Holi and all the other coming of the light things that all of our faith traditions do. We need to be reminded this time of year that the light in fact comes back and it eventually gets warm again. At least that's my theory. I think it's just good psychology to remind you it changes. And we have our light story in Buddhism as well. Some of us recently did a seven-day sesshin here at Zen Center called Rohatsu, which is to celebrate, to enact, actually, the enlightenment of Buddha. Buddha's enlightenment is December 8th. So same time of year as these other light holidays. The enlightenment of Buddha is our story. So I'm going to talk today about the three temptations of Buddha that happen under the Bodhi tree before his enlightenment, to help create his enlightenment. And I know a lot of you know this story, so I'm giving a short version, but for some of you this is new, and it's cool. It's a cool story. So in about 500 BC or so, in northern India, what is now northern India, at the end of his six-year spiritual quest, a man named Siddhartha sat down under a tree and he vowed not to rise again until he had realized freedom. And knowing that a Buddha was about to be born, Mara, the deceiver, which is the villain of the piece, supposedly, although he also catalyzes it, so eh. Mara, the deceiver, tries his last and best efforts to prevent this Buddha from happening. So he tries to move Siddhartha off his seat with the three temptations of greed, fear, and shame. So Siddhartha is first tempted by Mara's three beautiful daughters, and they fail to move him. Siddhartha simply says, "I see you, Mara," and they disappear. Since he can't pull Siddhartha off his seat with desire, Mara tries pushing him off of his seat with fear. He sends a terrible army and a rain of arrows. But when the raining arrows enter Siddhartha's field of awareness, they turn into flowers, and they fall all around him at his feet. So finally, Mara demands of him, "What gives you the right to become a Buddha? Who do you think you are?" In response, Siddhartha simply reaches down and just touches the earth. Like this, just gently touches the earth. Mara demands of him, "Who bears you witness?" And the entire earth herself, in a voice as vast as mountains of thunder, says, "I bear you witness." And so Mara is defeated, and Siddhartha becomes the Buddha. So there's our Christmas story. Happy Rohatsu. So we're talking about this story today, the three temptations, and we're talking about keeping our seat, how he keeps his seat through these things. And when we talk about mythological stories, myths and mythological stories like this, we get to use our imagination to let this story move us, to let us touch it a little more deeply. The details and myths are about ourselves. They aren't literal places, people, and things. These are representative of parts of our own lives, and they are talking to all of us about something universal to the human experience. So we can have a little more fun, I think, and we can be a little more intimate with mythological stories like this if we enter into them using our imagination. Right? Imagination is closer to truth than thinking is. So we have a chance to do that here today. So as we're talking about them today, as I'm just sort of working through the story, I encourage you to sort of pay attention to the parts that sort of grab you. You know, your personal history is a little different than mine, so what's going to grab me is going to be a little different probably than what's going to grab you. Sort of pay attention to the one that has the juice for you with these three temptations. Maybe that has to do with the overall arc of your life. Maybe it has to do with just where you happen to be right now in your life, but sort of listen. Sort of listen for the one that grabs you today. Because this story and these temptations are certainly not unique to somebody named Siddhartha, 500 BC. They are familiar to all of us. They're happening right here, right now. And this story is one of the functions of this story. There's a lot of different interpretations of this, of course. You're just getting my version. But one of the functions of this story is to show how we deal with the three poisons in Buddhism. In Buddhism, the cause of suffering is the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion. The things you want more of, the things you want less of, and your misunderstanding, your fundamental ignorance, the places you just get it wrong, right? So greed, hate, and delusion, these are the causes of suffering, and this is what he is forced to sit with. So we'll talk about them in order. The first one is greed, desire, selfish craving or grasping. And the story goes that Siddhartha is first tempted by Mara's daughters. I love that they're his daughters. That's really interesting to me. And I love that they have names. So on your... are there names? Yeah, the names are on your program there, Tanha, Arati, and Raga. The verse says, they had come to glittering with beauty, Tanha, Arati, and Raga, but the teacher swept them away right there, as the wind sweeps a piece of dandelion fluff. Isn't that cool? I actually changed I added the dandelion fluff because I just think it's a really sweet phrase, dandelion fluff. But here's the cool thing. Those three names are craving, boredom, passion. That's what he's really dealing with. Right? It's a little more complicated than we think at first. This is more than just, ooh, lust. That's part of it too. But this is much bigger than that. Craving, boredom, and passion. So, of course, when I read this story first, the arising, you know, he's sitting Zazen under his tree, and what arises is craving, boredom, and passion. Like, well, that's every period of Zazen I've ever had for the past 20 years. At some point, craving, boredom, or passion show up, right? These are the desires we deal with on the cushion. They can even prevent us from getting to the cushion in the first place. Right, playing video games, surfing the internet, eating chocolate cake is more fun than Zazen. Ta-da! Mara wins again. And the first temptation is desire, our greedy desire, that first poison. This is anything that we lean toward. We lose our balance. We move off our seat towards something when we're grasping after it. Oh, if I only had the... Right? We see this show up in our experience all the time. And when Siddhartha sees the desire arise for what it is, he defeats it by saying, I see you, Mara. And that's really interesting. All he does is see it. He names it. That's it. Right? He doesn't have to build a fence between him and the thing. He doesn't have to eradicate the thing. Right? The daughters aren't killed. He doesn't run away. He doesn't prevent them from... No, he just says, I see you. I see you. Right? It's just awareness. This is exactly what we do in the cushion every time we sit on the cushion. We're just practicing clear seeing. I see you. I see you for what you are. Okay. It's almost friendly, really. I mean, I'm used to adventure stories where the good guy's supposed to kill the bad guy. Here he's like, I see you. That's it. I see you, Mara. And when he does this, when he recognizes the desire for what it is, craving, boredom, and passion are swept away like a piece of dandelion fluff. That's pretty cool. We do this. We do this on the cushion. We do this on the cushion. Your mind wanders off. You know you got about 20 minutes left to go in the sitting, and you're already bored, and you're thinking, I think there probably is one piece of cake left in the fridge. You know, so when I'm done, I'm probably gonna, you know, what would really be good is, later I got to make sure to, and you catch yourself doing it. You just see it like, I see that you're wandering to something that you want right now. No problem. But not now, right? And so you just gently return your mind to this. You just come back. In that instant, am I right? That's gone, like dandelion fluff. It's just gone. And maybe it shows up again 3 seconds later. I don't know. If it does, welcome to being a human. But, you know, in that instant, poof. I see you. I see you're wanting something that isn't here. Okay. Right? It's not as complicated as we make it sound. We just see it for what it is. So the lesson here is that desire loses its power over us when we see into it. We not only recognize it for what it is, but we start to see through it. We start to see into it. We start to see, when we're on the cushion, how we create it. We start to see how we create it, how we like that story, how we nurse that story, how we inject that story, how we, right? And then a body of feeling starts getting generated. Ooh, and then the feeling feeds the story, and then the story feeds the feeling, and then, right? I'm doing this all by myself. I'm choosing to do this. And when I recognize that I'm choosing to do it, and I see how I'm creating it, I also see the mechanism by which I can stop. I can stop. I can make a choice. I see you. I see that I'm doing this. I'll stop doing this. So some of you know the name Charlotte Joko Beck, American Zen teacher, who we lost a couple years ago, I think. We lost Joko Beck. But she's a contemporary and a very influential, wonderful American Zen teacher. And she has some advice from us when we notice, when we do this noticing, when we notice that desire has gripped us, craving has gripped us, boredom has gripped us. She advises us to look for its cause. She says, look for its cause. Look for its source. Where's it coming from? Where's it coming from? It doesn't show up out of nowhere. Nothing shows up out of nowhere. Its causes and conditions create everything, right? Where is it coming from? What are the causes and conditions that are giving rise to your desire? And when it comes to greed, it's actually a pretty simple mechanism, right? We only want something when we think we lack it. Right? Duh. We only want something we think we don't have. The buffet has no appeal for us if we feel full. Right? The buffet doesn't cause desire. It's just a bunch of stuff. Many more than craving, boredom, and desire do. So when I feel I'm lacking something, desire is born in me. Those are the causes and conditions of desire. And I really like the word feel here. I think feel is key. Because we can actually have enough and not feel like we have enough. Right, that's called America. In case you didn't recognize that. How many cars is enough? How many TVs is enough? How many relationships is enough? Right, we are absolutely up to our eyebrows in not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough, when we all have enough. So Buddha taught that desire is infinite. It will always arise. It will always arise. There is no such thing as enough. Right? Until you see the seeds, until you see the causes and conditions, and you address those, it will continue to arise. And we all know this. This is a perfect time of year for this metaphor, because we all know the Christmas morning metaphor of getting a whole bunch of stuff and being thrilled and outrageously content for about an hour. And then we want something else. And we see, I get it, desire itself is infinite. It's totally unrelated to the pile of new Legos that I got, or the whatever that whole thing is. It's not quenchable. So, we actually, I think, as 21st century Americans, have a real opportunity to see this, because this really is our culture, and never enough is kind of our mantra, our collective American mantra right now. And it's certainly helping to rapidly destroy our world. And because we have an opportunity to not only be 21st century Americans, but also meditation practitioners, we have a fabulous opportunity to see it be born in our mind, in our heart, right? Over and over, we just see it. We just see it. So let's do what Siddhartha did. Just see it. Name it. Keep our seats. Stay upright. Look very closely at desire when it arises. When it shows up in your consciousness, ask yourself some things about it. Investigate it. Look more closely. Am I really lacking? Do I really need this to be whole? Do I need this to survive? What is this desire actually about? Is there something in me that's causing this? Especially if it's a repetitive one. If it's one of your favorite daydreams, the thing you want, the thing you want, the thing you want, the thing you want. Look at the soil of your mind there that's giving rise to that. And I'll say this just to sort of soften it a little bit, because I think we have a tendency to take this to sort of a teeth-gritting kind of self-restraint, not let yourself have any fun, or go to a thou shalt sort of place with it. At least I do. It's one of my favorite places to go. Don't let it be that. This is not about having a holy lifestyle. What it is about is knowing really deeply who we actually are, what we actually need, and what actually helps. And knowing what doesn't help, right? If I'm feeling lonely and I'm eating cookies to take care of a feeling called loneliness. That doesn't work. It actually doesn't. So I'm not stupid for feeling lonely. I'm not even maybe stupid for trying this tactic. It probably seems like it works for a little while. I just have to look really, really carefully at what it is I'm trying to actually address in myself, and then figure out the tactic I'm trying to use and see whether or not they actually match up. Do they actually match up? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But knowing what helps, knowing what doesn't. So look carefully at what pulls at you and look at why it pulls at you. So, under the tree, Siddhartha was unmoved by his desire. He felt it, he knew what it was about, he named it, he released it, and he kept his seat. And of course, Buddhism, the point of all these stories is just to remind you, you get to do it too. It isn't that he was magic. If he can do it, you can do it. So the invitation is to find that in yourself, your ability to do it. So next is fear. Of course, this is the opposite. Very same dynamic, but the opposite tactic. The opposite of wanting more is wanting less, fear. And since he can't pull Siddhartha from his seat with desire, Mara tries pushing him off of it with the opposite. And fear in us, the experience of fear very easily becomes anger and hate. So we're really still dealing with the second poison here. If fear is something you really, really, really hate, look carefully. You're scared, I promise. You just are. You know, it's not born all of itself. There's causes and conditions for hate, and it's fear. So look at it. So Mara, according to the story, of course, sends this army and this rain of arrows. I really love this image. And when they enter his field of consciousness, his field of awareness, they turn into flowers. Again, he's just seeing it for what it is. I see you. I see what this is. I see you, fear. Fear, aversion, anything we lean away from. Right? We want to keep our seat. We want to sit upright. And this is anything that makes us go, I don't like the, right, whatever that is. We certainly don't like arrows and armies. We're scared of those. Snakes, my boss, in-laws, whatever your deal is, fear shows up lots of different ways. So he's trying to push him off his seat. You know, this is just the standard Scooby-Doo villain tactic that every Scooby-Doo villain used to try to, like, oh, I've got the gold and it's in the amusement park and I want to make sure nobody goes there, so I just pretend that I'm a ghost and scare you all away. He's doing exactly the same thing. There's, like, no originality here. I mean, poor sweet Mara is trying his best, but this really is Scooby-Doo sort of level tactic. Like, oh, I get it. You're trying to scare me away by pretending. Oh. So again, when we see through it, just like Scooby-Doo and the gang did, like, oh, you're actually not a ghost. You're just a guy with a projector and a sheet. Ta-da! Fear goes away, right? The arrows are transformed into flowers. And that's the same for us. Our fears are something we're encouraged to bring into the light. Pay attention to them. Turn toward them. They're there for a reason. You're not an idiot. Your fear is there for a reason. You've been conditioned to have it. What's going on there? Look more carefully at it. What are you scared of? Where's the pain? Where's the hurt? Look at it. Because then, you start to ventilate that. The story becomes less real. You start to be able to see into it. These things wither and die when they're exposed to the light of our awareness. So this is just having a monster in the corner of your room and then having your mom turn on the light and you see it's a bathrobe over a chair. I use that example a lot because I had a tremendously frightening bathrobe when I was a kid. I'm just saying, it took a lot of my mom turning on the light and going, oh, right, 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 bathrobe on chair. not scary. Monster, scary. What's the difference? One I have no awareness of, and one I have a lot of awareness of. That's what we're doing. We're looking really, really carefully at it. So when fear arises in you next, I suggest, and I suggest you do this with a smaller fear, because this, building our muscles on these things is really important to do with smaller examples. Name it. Fear. I'm experiencing fear. I see you, fear. Hello, fear. Where is it in your body? Is it your shoulders? Your breathing gets maybe up here in your chest, gets shallow. Maybe it's in your gut. I don't know how it shows up for you, but just notice it. Oh, I see. Here's how it's showing up. You've come to tell me something. What's your story? What are you scared of? You know, treat it like you would a little kid. Don't invalidate the fear. Don't scold the fear. Don't try to build a wall between you and it. Don't blame yourself for having it, for God's sake. Don't do that. Just come here. You've got a story to tell me. What is it? What are you scared of? Let's talk about it, right? We're just more awareness, more awareness. Tell your story. More air, more ventilation. Hello, I see you. I see you. When you listen to it, it will tell you a story about being hurt. If you listen long enough, I promise that's where it will go. It always will go there. I've been hurt. If you listen to it with kindness, if you inquire further, if you ask questions, and above all, if you feel it, you have to allow it to be a feeling. Does that make sense? Not a story. You have to feel it. I feel you. It's hard. I mean, what I'm asking you is hard because it's hard to be with. We do not want to be with fear. It's one of the hardest things for us to be with. But you have to be with the feeling. I feel you, clenched gut. Oh, you're scared, aren't you? Okay, here I am. I'm breathing with you. Right? I'm right here with you. We're going closer to it. That's what starts to transform this experience. This is our bare awareness. Just being with it, listening to it, being present to it. And when we are kind with our attention and we do listen, something starts to heal. Fear is not an enemy that we need to kill or ignore or shut off. It is a friend. It is trying to keep us safe. It needs our attention. And honestly, I love the metaphor of the arrows turning into flowers. I realize it's a very poetic metaphor, but that happens in this room on these Zafus all the time. All the time. It happened half an hour ago. Fear turning into something else by just our willingness to sit with it and see with it. Just breathe into it. I see you. It happens here all the time. These things aren't really lofty. They're quite simple. So you can do it. And the last one. The last one is shame. I'm calling it shame. This one has the most juice for me. The reason it has the most juice for me is because I see this one every day in my work as a Zen teacher and my work as a spiritual director when I meet with people one-to-one. This is about 8 out of 10 times this is what it comes down to. Shame. Oh, I get it. You're ashamed. Right? That's what it always, just over and over and over, it seems to get a lot of juice for me. So it's our third temptation, and at this point, Mara the deceiver, and again, deceive is a perfect word here. It's a deception. It's just not real. It's very believable. You're not stupid for falling for it. Neither am I. I fall for it too. But it's still a deception. It is the Scooby-Doo thing. It really is a projector and a sheet. But we have to see it as such. Mara the deceiver is trying to get Buddha, who's just about to be a Buddha, off his seat. And he's got to do this because it's just really bad for Mara business. Like, having a Buddha around is like, oh man, that's like Starbucks opening across the street if you're an independent. Right? It's really not a good idea. People are going to follow this guy. I've got to get rid of him. And I've tried fear and I've tried greed. Okay, I've tried the push-pull thing, no dice. So this is the best chance I have. This is my last chance, and it's his biggest gun. He demands, who do you think you are to be sitting there? Who do you think you are to be sitting there? What gives you the right? Right? Shame, shame. It's a darn good argument because Siddhartha, and some of us know the rest of the story, Siddhartha is a prince. He's supposed to inherit his father's kingdom. He has a wife. He has a kid. He's got social obligations. This is a highly stratified, incredibly organized social system. He is breaking loads and loads and loads of rules, even following a spiritual path in his 20s anyway. He's turning his back on a massive number of social conventions, and that's what this whole thing is about, social conventions, the rules of society, obligation, family, duty, worldly power, all the thou shalts, fame and fortune, right? This is our collective, these are the things we hold collectively valuable. And he's saying no to every one of them. You know, when he sits down on that seat underneath that tree, he is renouncing his whole history. He's renouncing his whole history. He's not even Siddhartha anymore. He has no parents, he has no family, he has no obligation, he has nothing. He's left absolutely everything. That's still radical. 2,500 years later, that's insanely radical. We still, in this tradition, call ordination home leaving. You're leaving it. The whole story, you're leaving it. Symbolically, right, you're trying to leave this whole thing behind. That whole thing. And that's what it's designed to do, is cut off this idea of shame. And we all know this shaming voice. We all know this. This is the voice that wants to keep us small, to keep us doubting ourselves, to not risk, to hide, to cower, to stay quiet. It says we're bad. It says we're not wanted. It says we're not lovable. It says we're not worthy. It says we have no right because we don't matter. It says we're broken when we're not broken. This is the inner critic gone mad. Tim talks a lot about the inner critic. This is the inner critic on steroids. I'm assuming you all recognize this voice. You all know this voice? Good, thank you. So shame is irrational. It is unhelpful. It is judgmental. It's also untrue. And it's also, strangely, universal. It's universal. You have it. Nothing's wrong with you. The person sitting next to you has it. You don't have it because it's true. You have it because it's universal. And the truth is, most of us, I almost wrote all of us, but I decided to back it off. Most of us will live our entire lives with some version of this in our heads, some version of this lie. Thank you, folks, for helping with whatever's going on back there. You know what I need is a wah-wah pedal.
Just the voice of the earth.
That'd be pretty cool. That'd be pretty cool. We'll talk later. Am I not feeding back? Okay, cool. Thank you. So the universality of this is a little bit like when we hear the universality of dukkha, the very first noble truth. One of the things I hope that does when we hear, oh, every human gets this, is take away the idea that, oh, I have this because I'm doing it wrong. Right? Don't you just assume that you're suffering in life because you're doing it wrong? And that other people don't because they're doing it right? I'm assuming you make that. Of course you do. When Buddha says, oh yeah, it's the universal human condition, everybody gets it, you can just let go of the voice that says you have this because you're broken. He doesn't say there isn't things to improve, that you cause your own suffering. That's implicit. But the idea that somehow you're unique in that, or that you're the one who's doing it wrong, no. That's something else entirely. So most of us live our entire lives with some version of a shame voice in our heads. This is, for a lot of us, the script we live by and are unaware of it. Some of us admittedly are plagued by it more than others. When it's a normal amount, it's probably invisible. You don't even know it's there. When it's a lot, we call it depression. The voice becomes so strong that shame becomes an actual physiological disease. When people hear, who do you think you are, long enough, loud enough, in their head, they can even kill themselves. This is Maro's most powerful voice, and it kills almost 1 million Buddhas to be on this planet every year. Almost 1 million people on this planet kill themselves every year because of this voice. And of course, it wounds billions of others all the time, every day, including me, including you. So, most of us never think to question this shame voice because of two assumptions. One, we think that voice is ours. Two, we think that voice is true. So, that's terrifically sad to me because it is neither one of those things. It is not yours, and it is not true. A, that shame voice that lives in your head isn't yours. I'm going to introduce you to the idea that no child on this earth, in the history of recorded time, has been born with "I'm not enough" in their head. It does not exist. I have no right. will never occur spontaneously. That has to be taught. Has to be. It's not your voice. It's been there a long time. Sounds like yours. Shows up, sounds like you, but it's not. It's not your voice. We learned this from people who were just as scared and ashamed, and they didn't know otherwise. Right? There's no villain here other than the voice. This is called delusion in Buddhism. It's misunderstanding reality. It's the third poison. It's just misunderstanding something. And B, that shame voice in your head is not true. It's a lie. And if you want to see how it's a lie, I encourage you to try this exercise. Pull into your heart right now someone that you adore. Someone you dearly, dearly adore. Someone precious to you. This could be a person. It could be a pet. It could be somebody living or dead. Hold them in your mind. Hold them in your heart. And imagine asking them to listen to the same script that we so often think we deserve. Say to this person that you love, you don't deserve to be happy. You're awful for being exactly who you are. Ask this person, who do you think you are to try something brave or new? What gives you the right to express yourself? Why do you think you get to feel joy? It's painful, isn't it? It's like physically painful. When I do this at home, I'm just like, it's wrenching. When that voice shows up in my head, applying to me, makes perfect sense. I think it's true. When it applies to you, who I love, I see it for exactly what it is. It's a lie. It's never helpful. So when we do this exercise, we see it for what it is. It's a petty lie, it's small-minded, and it's stupid. It's lazy thinking. It's not helpful. And we can live our entire lives by a small, stupid script that we did not write just because we don't know otherwise. Buddhism implores us to know otherwise. That's why we sit down on the seat. Know otherwise. Look closely. Find out the truth. Is it true? Look. And Siddhartha's answer, his beautiful answer to who do you think you are, was just to reach down and gently touch the earth. That's all he did. Isn't that cool? No arguing words. Nothing. He's not even engaging this. Just he touches the earth. The word for this earth witness, there's a Sanskrit term for the earth witness mudra. Bhumi Sparsha. Bhumi Sparsha. Bhumi Sparsha. And that's a good answer that he gave. To just reach down and touch the entire earth with one soft, warm, little human hand. That's the answer to shame. So Mara demands of him, who bears you witness? Right? And of course, the entire earth herself. The entire earth herself, in her thunderously vast voice, I bear you witness. I bear you witness. And this part of the story always chokes me up. I'm glad I got through it today. It always does. I've heard it, I don't know, at least 100 times, and it always chokes me up. And it's beautiful to me, this earth touching and the fact that the whole earth bears him witness. I think the reason I find it so beautiful is because my heart knows it's true. I know in my head it's just a story, but something in my heart goes, that's true. That's true. We are all of us, witnessed and supported in ways we will never, ever know. And when the entire earth says, I bear you witness, I go, that's just true. That's just true. Of course it's true. Would there be something that isn't bearing him witness? Of course. His enlightenment is my enlightenment. His enlightenment is your enlightenment. Every single thing supports it. How could it not? How could it not? Of course the whole earth bears him witness. The Jewish Talmud says, every blade of grass has its own angel that bends over it and whispers, grow, grow. Isn't that cool? Bodhisattvas everywhere. That's what this is about. I bear you witness. Grow, right? Life doesn't want us to not grow. It wants us to grow. It bears us witness. It supports us. So, the Buddha touches the earth. The earth bears him witness. And Mara knows he's beaten and he scampers off. Till next time. He'll be back. But he scampers off, poor guy. So why didn't shame work? How does this apply to us? Shame doesn't work in that moment on Siddhartha because his mind is in mindfulness. He's doing zazen under that tree. Zazen, mindfulness, is a state of non-judgmental awareness. I know you guys all know that. That's what the definition of mindfulness is, non-egoic awareness, non-judgmental awareness. There's no judge there. Who do you think you are? Like, what? How is that relevant? What are you even talking about, dude? You're talking to somebody who isn't here. That's not happening right now. I'm not there. There's no ranking, judging, evaluating, good, bad, thou shalt. What are you talking about? I'm sitting. This is zazen. It is outside of all of those things. There is no judge to appeal to. There is no ego to cause a reaction in. There is no desire. There is no fear. There is no shame. This is zazen. This is your mind. Your mind when you do zazen too. Right? Isn't that the project? That's why this teaching is so important for us. We hurt others and we hurt ourselves when we act from desire and fear and shame. Every time we act from desire and fear and shame, we hurt ourselves and we hurt others. That's why we address them in Buddhism. These are the poisons. They cause suffering. We have the capacity to act wisely. We have the capacity to act compassionately when we are free of these things, which is why we sit zazen. We practice this kind of non-judgmental awareness. We sit because we practice Buddha. We sit because we are Buddha. We sit to practice. We sit to be. We sit to be Buddha. So to wrap up here, this myth about Buddha isn't a myth. It's real. And it's not about Buddha. It's about all of us. And we deal with temptations, each one of us, all the time, both on the zafu and off. Collectively, we are learning together how to sweep away craving and boredom and passion. Collectively, we are learning together how to sweep away fear, how to sweep away shame. And we do this in epic ways, like the Buddha did, and we do it in very, very subtle ways. It's a bunch of stuff, the way this shows up in your life. It's the cookie you choose not to eat, or the feeling you choose not to run away from, but instead to just feel and listen to, or the dream job you just dare yourself to apply for, or it's just telling somebody that you love, I love you. Or it's the hurtful thing that you think and you decide not to say. Right? It's the crappy core belief that you decide to examine and you decide to practice letting go. It's the abusive relationship you decide to leave. It's the poem you choose to share with someone. And especially when we sit zazen and we sit up straight with dignity, enacting Buddha, becoming Buddha. There it is. We're engaging with this stuff all the time. This is not an abstraction. It's not 2,500 years ago. It's not about someone else. It's right now. And you get to do it moment after moment, right? So this story exists. It's a fabulous story. I'm only skating along the surface. There's so much you can do with this. But this story of the three temptations and him becoming Buddha exists to help normalize our experience of practice, both on the zafu and off. Obviously, temptation is not limited to sitting cross-legged on a black cushion. This story is intended to be about us, to help us, because these temptations arise in our consciousness all the time. You've probably had about a dozen since I've started this talk, at least. I've got a focus, so I've only had about six. Because we're always tempted by autopilot, unconsciousness, habitual ego functioning. And because we always have those things, we also always have the ground for practice, right? We're constantly being tempted by these things. They're showing up all the time. Wow, here's an opportunity to practice. Here's an opportunity to let it go. Here's an opportunity to see it as dandelion fluff and sweep it away just by letting go, right? I get to be Buddha right now. Here's the chance to do it. Here's when it happens. We always have a chance in each moment to make where we are that same immovable spot. Keeping that seat, free from desire, free from fear, free from shame. Mara wants to move us from that seat, and our job is to keep it. And the more we practice, the better we get. And as you're sitting here today, whether you're in a chair or on a cushion, are you not sitting on the whole earth? Are you not sitting on the whole earth? When you reach down and touch the ground, are you not touching the whole earth? Is she not there all the time bearing you witness? Where else can you sit? Maybe ask yourself who in your life bears you witness in a more tangible way. Who is that person? There's somebody who bears you witness. So when you hear Mara's voice, just say firmly, you can say it gently, I see you. I see you, Mara. I see you. Because the ability to do this simple thing that he did belongs to each of us. And the right to reach down and touch the entire earth belongs to each of us. So when you need the support, please do it. It's right there waiting for your warm hand. And just like she does for the Buddha, the entire earth herself is bearing you witness in every moment. And she never argues for your smallness. She never argues for your smallness. Listen. Instead, she is always bearing you witness and helping you to keep your seat. Thank you very much for your attention today. We still have a few minutes, anyway. If you've got questions or comments or other interpretations of that myth or something, Deb.
I have a question, comment, favorite. Why is that you mentioned that you would not say to your favorite person?
Oh, yes.
Could you take one or two of them and reverse them to what you would like to say to yourself or your favorite person?
You bet. That's a great idea.
That sounds like a good thing to do for yourself when you're not feeling so good.
I completely, yep. Yep. I love it. It's we could call that right effort.
Yeah.
Really, right?
Say, you are a good person. You do deserve this.
Yep. Turn it into like an affirmation.
Yeah.
An affirmation reminder. Yeah. Yeah. For the sake of this, I just like the way it normally shows up is how I kind of want to recognize it. Like, oh, I know how you show up. But you're right. It's reversing it is just making a choice. I know I don't want to water these seeds. The ones that say, I can't do this. What I do want to water are the ones that... So even asking yourself, like, what would you say to your loved one? Geez, I'm thinking about applying for my dream job, but I don't know if I should. You know, you just be like, oh my God, are you kidding? Go for it. So writing yourself a note, like, this applies to you too. Oh, go for it, go for it, go for it, you know. It's a great idea. And it's very direct, you know, because then it's... By flipping it, you're actually using its own language, in a sense, kind of against it, like you actually do, to turn a negative into a positive. Yeah. That's a great idea.
Open to possibilities of this is not how it has to be.
Yeah.
It can be.
Yeah. Thank you. I like that a lot. Other folks. Oh, Stephanie.
Yeah, I really like how you said it's an amazing thought. To me, that makes the most sense. I wonder if we all feel ashamed, then what is maybe the upside of it? Why is it taught?
Mm.
So useless.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's actually not.
Mm.
So useless. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just maybe because we all have to work on our moral development, and some of us don't think that they do. They get, you know. Sorry, I'm not making a lot of sense, but I'm.
No, I'm getting it. Yeah.
For a young person to be socialized, it might take some shame.
Oh, it has to happen. Yeah.
It's a pretty powerful tool, and it can cut pretty deep. And if we don't learn how to use it, we keep cutting ourselves. Where we really, all it's maybe in a good way is meant to do is make us social beings.
Yep.
So that we don't become asocial.
Yep.
So if we look at it not as something that is either this or that. I don't know if I can actually put this into words, but maybe we could even look at that with a little bit of a sense of gratitude. Someone
mm-hmm.
maybe not so skillfully, taught us something to send us on our way to become social creatures. Yes, there's a bit of a curse, but as we grow older and grow a sense of humor, we can actually contain it. And then it's not so bad.
I totally agree, yeah. I love, of course, and this is, I know my audience, like, we're all grown-ups who have probably outgrown the need to, like, beat ourselves senseless every time we drop a teacup or something like that. And I totally agree with you. I think, like, we're social beings, and of course the social function of shame is if you don't do things according to the tribe, we kick you out and you die. Like, that's why we've evolved as beings that have this, like, it has a function. Secondarily, like, developing a conscience is something else. Like, oh, I did a bad thing. You got to know that. Yeah, you hurt somebody. You did a bad thing. But the difference between guilt, I did a bad thing, and shame, I am a bad thing. Ah, wow, we got an entirely different deal going on here. But yeah, one of the great things about the temptations and one of the great things about Mara, of course, is he's the great catalyst that causes this thing to happen. You know, we learn who we are by seeing what we're not. I'm not desire. I'm not fear. I'm not shame. So, Even as a voice in your head that provides contrast to what you really are, it has function. And I'm fond of the way Tim actually frames this whole thing. Oh, Mara's just Buddha in disguise. Like, sure, he's the villain of the piece, but, you know, tomorrow they can change clothes and then pretend to be each other. This is all part of the game of consciousness. So, yeah, crucially important social functioning. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have culture. You have to, you know, it has an incredibly important cultural function, but what makes me sad, and of course this is what I see all the time, is 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 70-year-olds who are still dealing with, I have to go to my room because I'm bad. And I'm like, that stopped being true when you were 5. And you weren't ever bad, you just did a bad thing or an unskillful thing, and you made somebody else anxious, and so da-da-da-da-da, and you try to unpack it for them. But I totally agree. Yeah, all these things are catalysts for our growth, right? Isn't that fun? Yeah. Mara doesn't go away. You guys know how the story goes. I mean, he keeps showing up. I mean, he keeps showing up and showing up and showing up. It's like, oh, come on in. Have some tea. Let's talk, sweetie. What do you got for me today? So, thank you, Stephanie. Okay. Oh, Laura.
Can I steal something that Mark Turak said?
yes, we can all steal from Mark.
I liked, so we were talking very briefly about this one time, and I liked what he said, and I thought I wanted to share because he didn't like it, he was going to. He likes to think of the arrows turning into flowers as Buddha just realizing their true nature. So the things that maybe scare us are just misunderstood. They might actually really have a beautiful nature deep down that we're not seeing because of our fear.
Important function. I totally agree. Well said, Mark.
To make that story a little bit more awesome, it was a conversation. It was exchanged on Facebook between all
of us. A whole other layer.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I love the way this story, because you're right. It is always about awareness. That's the thing that transforms it. Of course, we need fear. I mean, you have to recognize walking alone in woods, see bear, go other direction. Bear kills you, can kill you, right? Like, fear has an incredibly important function. It's not an enemy. It just needs to be seen and understood. So I totally agree with this on Facebook. You kids today and you're... All right. Thank you very much.